Welcome to the GRF On The Go podcast. The subject matter experts at GRF CPAs and Advisors created this podcast to offer insights on current topics, as well as new ideas and best practices that your team can apply today. This podcast was originally presented as a live webinar. CPE information provided during the podcast is no longer valid, but if you're interested in watching the video version of this session or accessing the slide deck, visit our website at grfcpa.com/events. Enjoy the episode and remember to subscribe for future content.
Well, hello everyone. I want to welcome you all to today's webinar, Understanding the 2024 OMB to CFR 200 Uniform Guidance Changes. My name is Andrew Dial. I'm an audit manager here at GRF. Today, we are joined by my colleagues, Tricia Catabini, Mac Lillard, and John McIntosh. Tricia is a partner in our audit department. Mac is a senior manager in our risk and advisory services department. And John is a senior manager in our audit department. The four of us have a wealth of experience and knowledge in dealing with uniform guidance standards. So we have a lot of great stuff to share with you today. Please note that this webinar is not intended as financial or legal advice. This is simply for educational purposes. And then a little background about our firm. We are GRF CPAs and Advisors. We're based out of Bethesda, Maryland. We serve clients in the DMV as well as nationally and internationally. Our firm serves a wide range of clients covering not-for-profits, for-profits, schools, government contractors, and others. However, our particular niche is within the not-for-profit and INGO space. We've been in operation for several decades. In fact, in 2021, we celebrated our 40-year anniversary. And as you can see here, we have a lot to cover in today's conversation. So without further ado, let's get right into it.
Thank you, Andrew. Good morning, everyone. My name is John McIntosh, and as Andrew mentioned, today our main topic will be the updates to the 2024 revisions to the uniform guidance. We have four sections here. Our first section is really going to be an overview of what the uniform guidance is and how single audits relate to the uniform guidance. Then I'm going to take you through the actual updates and revisions that are coming out this year. Then I'm going to turn it over to Tricia. She'll take us through how your organization can prepare for the changes and best practices related to those. And then finally, Mac is going to close it out with the cybersecurity considerations that come with the new revisions. So as I mentioned, our first topic is just going to be an overview of the uniform guidance and single audit. And it's really important to first understand what the uniform guidance is before you can actually get into what's being changed this year. And of course, the uniform guidance is the rules set forth for federal grant management laid out in the CFR 200. And single audit really refers to the type of audit that a federal award recipient is required to undergo when their annual expenditures of federal awards exceed the single audit threshold. And really, the term single audit can be a little misleading in itself, as there's really two separate components to a single audit. First, you have the audit of the organization's financial statements, including their schedule of expenditures of federal awards, more commonly known as a CFA. And then the second component is the audit of their compliance with the terms and conditions of their federal awards. So what is the uniform guidance? As I said, it's really a set of regulations that provides a government-wide framework for grant management. It's officially titled Section 2 of the Code of Federal Regulations 200, Uniform Administrative Requirements, Cost Principles, and Audit Requirements for Federal Awards. That's a very long title, so we usually just cut that down and call it the Uniform Guidance or the UG. And the UG was really originally issued by the Office of Management and Budget in December 2013 and was effective for 2014. And the UG really consolidated and streamlined the previous guidance from the various different OMB circulars into one document for ease of use and access. And who does the guidance really apply to anyways? It applies to all recipients of U.S. federal awards, including nonprofit organizations, local governments, institutes of higher education, and tribal governments. And the OMB's ultimate goal with the uniform guidance was to standardize how non-federal entities manage their federal awards to make the process more efficient, more transparent, and ultimately more accountable. And the guidance can be accessed by anybody at any time for free by just visiting the ecfr.gov. This is certainly the most up-to-date version, as it's the electronic version. There's other versions that exist out there on the web. If you Google CFR 200 in PDF format, those ones quickly become outdated. So we certainly always recommend that you access the ECFR for the latest information. Now, if you read the guidance, it's really broken up into six separate subparts. And each of these subparts is important to understand. The first is subpart A on acronyms and definitions. And as the name would suggest, this is really a list of definitions and key terms that are frequently used throughout the guidance and sort of acts like a glossary for the rest of the other subparts. Subpart B on general provisions. This section really establishes the uniform administrative requirements and contracting policies for the actual federal agencies that issue the awards. Section C is pre-federal award requirements. And Section D is post-federal award requirements. And Section E, cost principles, are really the two most important subparts for actual recipients of awards. Section D focuses on the recipient's administrative and logistical requirements. And Section E is really used in determining the allowability of costs incurred by the recipients and the rules related to recording and incurring expenditures. And finally, the last part is subpart F, and this is, of course, our personal favorite part. And this is the section on audit requirements. And this section dictates how an auditor must and when they must conduct an audit under the uniform guidance and based on the cost principles. And it's really important to remember these six different subparts, since the 2024 revisions that we're going to be covering impact each of these subparts in sort of a large way.
All right, this brings us to polling question number one. Is your organization subject to the uniform guidance? Note, this does not mean a single audit only. If you receive any federally sourced funds, most likely your organization is subject to UG. Just a reminder, if you'd like to receive CPE, please complete this question.
All right, it looks like 73% of you said yes, your organization is subject. So glad to see that such a large percentage of you all and that this will be applicable to your organizations. All right, so now that we have a solid understanding of what the guidance is, we can really begin to talk about what's changing this year for the 2024 revisions. So the OMB periodically reviews the guidance and is actually required to issue updates to the guidance every 5 years. And since 2024 is the 10th anniversary of the guidance that began in 2014, this marks the second round of official revisions to the guidance. And back in April 2024, they issued the revised OMB guidance for grants and agreements, which is now officially referred to as the OMB guidance for federal financial assistance. And this second update is certainly considered by most to be the biggest update since the original release. And these revisions, were designed for a number of reasons, but ultimately it was designed to just kind of modernize the guidance and bring it up into the current year. And they started by issuing a pre-publication of the final revisions. You can actually find this pre-publication version at cfo.gov or just by Googling CFR 200 2024 revisions. And this one's really great because it has a red line version with the different changes. So you can really see what the guidance used to say and what it says now. And the current ECFR version I mentioned on the previous slide, that is that now reflects the updated revisions without the redline version. The revised document is over 450 pages long, so we're going to do our best to summarize it here for you. But the key goals of these revisions were to really increase access to funding for the various recipients, improve oversight and accountability for the recipients, and ultimately to align with today's national priorities. So what is the effective date for these revisions? The effective date for the changes is officially October 1, 2024. So just over 2 weeks ago, the new guidance went into effect. And it's really important to understand what the effective date means. So this is the effective date is specifically, the revisions are specifically for awards that are made or issued after October 1, 2024. If your organization has any pre-existing awards from before this date, you would be required to have a modification issued by the donor that states that you now, that the award qualifies for the revisions. So we're recommending that you know, you reach out to your agreement officers and request those revision modifications if you're desiring to have your awards under the new guidance. And one tip that we're recommending for all of our clients that require a uniform guidance audit is to, when you're preparing your CIFA, is to add a new column on your CIFA that indicates whether the different awards do or do not qualify for the new guidance. And this is really important because different audit procedures are going to need to be applied depending on if awards are or are not applicable to the new guidance. And one exception to the effective date is for the revisions to Subpart F on the audit requirements. And that is because, of course, audits follow fiscal years, not necessarily effective dates. So the Subpart F is going to be applicable to fiscal years beginning after October 1, 2024. So for example, if your organization has a December 31st fiscal year end, then your first fiscal year after October 1, 2024 is going to be starting January 1, 2025. So therefore, the Subpart F revisions will not be applicable until your fiscal year ended December 31st, 2025. The new guidance does have a couple of key changes in terminology. Throughout Subpart A through E, they have replaced the term non-federal entity with recipient. So this is the term that they use to refer to anyone that receives the awards. They used to say non-federal entity, and they now say recipient. They also changed what they used to call grants and agreements to federal financial assistance. So two specific changes there to keep in mind that just or for enhanced clarity in the guidance. So now that we have covered these intro items, let's now cover the specific revisions by subpart chronologically. So starting with Subpart A on the acronyms and definitions, there were several key changes here to, again, improve clarity and reflect modern practices. There were several key changes to some definitions, but probably the biggest definition change was that related to equipment. So equipment is generally defined as tangible property with a useful life of more than 1 year and a per unit acquisition cost of $5,000. The new guidance is now increasing that threshold from $5,000 to $10,000. So anything that was defined as equipment is now generally going to be considered over 10,000 rather than 5,000. And it's worth noting that your organization can still use a lower threshold than $10,000. However, those prior approvals for equipment purchases need to follow your organization's threshold. So if you elect less than 10,000, then you will need to get the prior approvals for equipment less than 10,000, or at least meeting your organization's threshold. The definition also provides for a good distinction between what is considered equipment and supplies, especially regarding items that can be considered either. So depending on their value or useful life. So equipment is usually durable and long-lasting and above a capitalization threshold, and supplies are generally considered to be consumable and used within a short period. And then one other kind of important aspect to equipment in the guidance is related to disposition of equipment at the end of the award. So they used to require that you report equipment that had a current fair market value of $5,000 at the end of a federal award. That is now also increasing to $10,000. The same threshold also relates to supplies. However, as we mentioned, when it comes to equipment disposition, it's at a per unit value basis. The new guidance for supplies is making it clear that supplies are at the total cost of your supplies. So if you have a supply purchase that exceeds $10,000, that would need to be reported as disposition. And this was kind of set out to avoid what would be considered recipient stockpiling at the end of a grant, and kind of adds a use it or lose it mentality to supplies. Another definition that changed a little bit is the definition of modified direct cost, specifically related to subaward exclusions when applying a indirect rate. It used to be that you could exclude up to 20, you could apply your indirect rate to the first $25,000 of a subaward. They're now increasing that to the first $50,000 of a subaward. So what does this mean? This means that recipients can now recover more indirect cost on each individual subaward. And just as a reminder, the test for a subaward is if the sub has programmatic decision-making capabilities. If they don't, then they're more likely a subcontractor, and these exclusion rules generally don't apply. One more definition they updated was that of question costs. Question costs are costs that are disallowed in a single audit. Currently, this is defined as cost charged to a federal award that are either not allowable under the relevant cost principles, that lack adequate supporting documentation in an audit sample, or appear unreasonable or unnecessary under the circumstances. So the revisions for the definition of question costs really provide some examples of types of expenditures that could be considered question costs, and clarifies what the document standards are related to this. All right, moving on to subpart B, general provisions. The biggest change under subpart B is in section 200.113 on mandatory disclosures. Currently, and as has always been the case, recipients are required to report violations of federal criminal law involving fraud, bribery, or significant violations of the law. What they're changing and updating with the revisions is that they state that these violations are now reportable when there is credible evidence. So the key change here is that they've added in that it is reportable when you have credible evidence. So it sort of lowers the bar on when things can be considered reportable to the funding agency. The revisions also provide increased details on what considers a conflict of interest. And this is being expanded to include organizational conflicts of interest rather than just individual conflicts. So the key takeaway here is that it's really important to expand your conflict of interest policy to cover board members in addition to regular employees if your organization's policy has not already done that. And the general provisions also have additional flexibilities with regard to the use of languages other than English. So they have a clause on translation of critical documents, and that requires federal awarding agencies to ensure that critical program documents are available in multiple languages, not just in English. Moving on to subpart C, the pre-award requirements. Really, the biggest revisions here were related to the use of fixed cost awards or fixed amount awards. And these are a type of funding instrument where the funding is based on the recipient achieving specific milestones or desired objectives rather than tracking detailed costs as you would with an assistance award. And fixed awards are particularly useful for reducing administrative burden, but revisions to these really include expanding the fact that unexpended funds may actually be retained by the recipient as long as the programmatic objectives and milestones have been achieved. But do not call the excess profit. There's certainly no profit motive for these, but they do state that any excess funding that was not spent can be retained. The revisions here also clarify that fixed awards are not subject to audit. So since there is no element of tracking costs, you do not have to put them on your organization's CIFA, and therefore they're not subject to being specifically audited under subpart F for compliance. And then one last change for fixed amount awards is that they increase the maximum amount of a fixed amount subaward from $250,000 to $500,000 with prior approval from your federal awarding agency. One more update on this subpart is related to notices of funding opportunities or NOFOs, and you can really consider these to be the advertisement that the federal agency puts out inviting an organization to submit a funding proposal. And the revisions here really stress that federal agencies should ensure that they provide clear direction to the applicants within the NOFO. They really are supposed to be using plain language that clearly communicates the requirements and the intentions of the funding. And the NOFOs are now required to have an executive summary and have a limit on their length so that they're more manageable to read. Subpart D is on the post-federal award requirements. Within this one, the biggest updates were to procurement. I think Tricia is going to cover some details on procurement in the next section, but some specific changes here. In section 200.318, general procurement standards, they modified the procurement standards to remove certain geographic preferences when it came to procurements. And then on methods of procurement to be followed, they had a terminology change here. What they used to refer to as a small purchase is now being called a simplified acquisition. And this change was really made to come into alignment with the FAR and the terminology used in the FAR, which really kind of has the procurement thresholds detailed in it anyways. And then one other change here is related to federal financial reporting. So federal awarding agencies now under the revisions must only require OMB approved government-wide data elements on recipient financial reports. And financial reports are not to be collected more frequently than yearly. So this is important because it really standardizes the federal financial reports across all agencies. And this is sort of a big deal since there's a lot of agencies that had their own financial reports and their own reporting timelines. And so now this standardizes that process for everyone. One last thing on subpart D is related to subrecipients and subcontractor determinations. And this has always kind of been an area of confusion, but they have now emphasized that pass-through entities are responsible for the subrecipient versus subcontractor determination. They also put emphasis that there's a lot of judgment involved here, but you should have a documented determination on if your sub is a recipient or a contractor. And this is really important because a subrecipient, they're subject to pre-award assessment and ongoing programmatic monitoring, while subcontractors are more so related to procurement.
All right, this brings us to polling question number 2. Which of the following would be considered an attribute of a subrecipient? Just a reminder that if you'd like CPE credit, please provide a response to this polling question.
All right, it looks like 74 people said that subrecipients have programmatic decision making. That is the correct answer. Glad to hear you all were listening to the previous sections. All right, moving on to subpart E, cost principles. One of the biggest updates here was to prior written approvals. Of course, there's a lot of items listed that do require prior written approval from your agreement officer to be considered allowable costs. From that list, the revisions are removing 9 categories. Those 9 categories are use of grant agreements, real property, equipment, direct costs, entertainment costs, memberships, participant support costs, selling and marketing, taxes, including VAT. I think it's important to note, though, that they did retain prior approvals required for foreign currency fluctuations. I think that there was some suggestions to have that one removed, but it was ultimately retained. But these changes really allow for more flexibility and autonomy in the management of the projects. But it should be noted that most of these still should be included in the original budget, especially the entertainment one. The entertainment must have direct programmatic project purposes and the costs that were included in the budget. Perhaps the biggest update to all the revisions is here in related to indirect costs, and that is that they have increased the de minimis cost rate from 10% to 15%. Note that it does state that it's up to 15%, so if your actual indirect rate is less than 15%, it's probably a good idea to only charge up to your actual and to have that documentation on hand. And also that you, as a recipient, are not allowed to elect the de minimis rate if you have an active NICRA in place. Other updates for NICRAs is that all federal agencies must now accept a NICRA that is in place. This is a big change since some agencies had previously not recognized organizations' NICRAs and had imposed some lower rates within the agreements. They're now not supposed to do that. And similar to pass-through entities must recognize sub-recipients' NICRAs. All right, moving on to our last subpart, subpart F on audit requirements. The biggest change here is related to the threshold for single audit and major program determination. Since the last update 5 years ago, the threshold for undergoing a single audit was if your CEFA exceeded $750,000, they've now increased that to $1 million. So for your fiscal years beginning after October 1, 2024, that threshold will be effective. One other significant change is related to report submission. So currently, single audit reports are required to be submitted to the Federal Audit Clearinghouse within 9 months of your fiscal year end. The guidance has now allowed a little bit of leniency and that your cognizant agency is allowed to authorize an extension to this if there is any undue burden placed on the auditee to meet this timeline or if there's really any kind of extenuating circumstances. But of course, you do need to receive that approval from the agency. All right, that brings us to the end of the revisions. I'm going to now turn it over to Tricia to go over the preparations.
Thank you, John. So there have been a lot of updates in the new uniform guidance revisions. One of the things, too, to just keep in mind is that there is a lot of what we call readability that has been updated and changed to clarify that language. So when we look through the new uniform guidance revisions, we're really looking to make sure that things are more streamlined and that the recipients of the federal assistance are able to really, in plain language, right, understand what the requirements are of them. So let's talk about the preparations that you as an organization should be making as you work through these updates for uniform guidance. So again, one of the key things here inside of the uniform guidance is that no matter what compliance area or requirement that may be applicable to your organization within those specific awards, there is a lot of clearly stated, documented requirements for written procedures and policies surrounding those compliance requirements. So when we are looking at all of the different awards that you have, ensuring that you have those written policies in place, you know, John mentioned a lot of them, procurement for instance, suspension and debarment. We want to make sure that those internal controls and those policies that are written are A, documented and formalized. That's really a key aspect of it. But then that they also match the requirements that are specifically outside of, or outlined, excuse me, inside of uniform guidance. Keep in mind too, that sometimes there are more stringent requirements by an organization. So long as they meet the minimum requirements of uniform guidance, you are allowed to go a little bit more stringent and be a little bit more strict. The next key thing here is to really just understand the effective dates. So again, you know, John mentioned those effective dates and when they're applicable for an organization. And really, again, starting after October 1st of 2024 is that a fiscal start for that year end of when these new changes will be applicable. So a lot of questions that we've been getting for organizations in particular is, well, when is that $1 million threshold increase going to apply to me and to our audits for when we will need them? So keeping in mind, if you are a 12/31 calendar year end, these requirements will be applicable for your 2025 audit. Same thing if you are a 6/30 year end, it's not going to be applicable until, unfortunately, your 6/30/2026 year-end audit. So we are still working towards kind of that threshold of $750,000, at least for the next year, we would say, of our audit processes for our organization. So do keep those in mind. The third thing that we have outlined here is really ensuring that you've enhanced your training for staff and the awareness of what they need to do in order to ensure that you all do remain compliant with uniform guidance requirements. So there are a lot of organizations that we typically work with who will get federal assistance awards and who will sign their names on the dotted line and not be aware that they have to actually comply with all of these requirements inside of uniform guidance. Some organizations think that only if they are required to have an audit will they have to have the written policies and procedures and ensure that staff are following the protocols that are inside of it. So again, training is a big thing here for your staff at your organizations, ensuring that they also understand what the compliance requirements are and what the internal controls for those compliance requirements are at your specific organization. John also mentioned, again, that indirect cost, that de minimis cost rate going up from 10 to 15%. And so if you do have a NICRA in place already, you cannot use that de minimis rate. But we've been getting a lot of questions as well, saying, well, my NICRA is only 12%. What do I have to do in order to get that 15% de minimis rate that is closer to something that they actually are spending when it comes to the administration of the awards? And so what we're really suggesting here is to reach out to your oversight agency and start those discussions now to see how you can get that de minimis rate. It may take a couple of years for you to get that into place, because again, if you have that, you're not able to use it. So ensuring that you have that approval in place for your NICRA and you're using it during the year and the time frame that you have that approval, and then you can transition potentially to the de minimis rate. But again, starting that conversation with your grants officers and managers is really going to be what our suggestion is to kind of work out that timeline and how to make it most efficient for you all, for one, as an organization, but also two, ensuring that you're not leaving a ton of money on the table, because obviously administration of these federal awards does take time, effort, which equals money. And then last but not least here on this slide, we are talking about collaborating with your auditor, whomever that might be, and ensuring that you understand what the compliance requirements are. If there are any questions at all on the internal control policies and procedures that you have outlined, ensuring that you have those formalized again, because it does take time to really update policies and procedures. So making sure that you're working with your auditor to ensure that you have what you need within those policies and procedures. Now, we all know that the federal government does not provide any kind of templates. They do not give any specific examples over what those policies and those procedures should look like and how they should be written, but they give you the guidelines within the uniform guidance. So going back to that, they are stressing and emphasizing that you as an organization should take the responsibility to ensure that you have those policies and procedures written in place. So making sure, again, that you're collaborating with all of the people within the organization, as well as with your auditors. And I do want to emphasize, other people within your organization simply because you may have a grants manager that maybe is outside of accounting, for instance, ensuring that you are working with them and that they understand what they need to do from their end, making sure that you have the communication channels across all of your departments and ensuring that people are understanding what is required of them is going to be a big thing. So again, when we talk about reviewing those policies and procedures, one of the bigger things that we really want to emphasize here specifically surrounds procurement and your procurement policy. This is one of those internal control policies that we see a lot of times not quite meeting the standards when it comes to uniform guidance. So these are a couple of revisions that likely need to be emphasized within your procurement policy. So again, making sure that you're including veteran-owned businesses in your contract prioritizations, making sure that you've got those affirmative steps. These again are going to be some of those big changes that you're going to see. Another terminology change really is the small purchase threshold, which has now gone to simplified acquisition. So we've all heard the terminology, the simplified acquisition thresholds. So you'll see it a little more clearly on my next slide here when we talk about the different types of procurement that there are, but making sure again that these terminology changes are updated within your specific policy and procedure. Sometimes we do have organizations that have geographic preference requirements written into their procurement policy. And that kind of goes along with that cost analysis when you do have bids that are required or requests for proposals out there. Again, those restrictions need to be removed. You need to make sure that you include all of the different bidders in there and allow and ensure that they are committed to being able to really do the best job for the best price for the federal government for the funds that they're being utilized there. And again, last but not least here on this slide, when it comes to procurement, really ensuring that we are looking at prioritizing environmentally sustainable products and services. So there's been a lot of conversation out there. I'm sure you all have heard of the acronym ESG. So again, making sure that things are environmentally sustainable, that we're looking at governance from that standpoint as well, to ensure that we are doing the best that we can, not only for our planet, because again, aligning the uniform guidance with the national priorities is where that emphasis is coming from here. So then again, we're talking about that uniform guidance. I've already mentioned to you here that they can be more restrictive in nature should you so desire. But again, you will be held through your audit process to that stricter requirement should you make it more strict than uniform guidance. So again, the uniform guidance methods here that have been changing, again, we still have the micro purchases. Instead of small purchases, we now have the simplified acquisitions, moving into the sealed bids, the request for proposals, and then the non-competitive procurement. Again, I do want to emphasize non-competitive procurement has not changed in this revision. However, it is one of the areas that we typically see the most common findings written about when it comes to procurement. One of the other key things here within the uniform guidance, again, we talked about the readability and the clarity and things being put into plain language. While we as auditors have always felt that there was an implication that the documentation of internal controls be there and a physical documentation of when it happened and who actually did the internal control approval, there has been a lot of pushback sometimes because the uniform guidance doesn't specifically state that it must be documented. However, inside of the new revision, there is clear language now that says and states that the internal controls over compliance must be documented. So again, from an auditor standpoint, if we can't see it happening, it didn't happen from our perspective. We don't have the evidence. We don't have the proof. So again, this emphasis remains here within the uniform guidance as well. So then just moving into the last polling question, Andrew, I will turn it on to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tricia. This brings us to polling question number 3. What information technology or cybersecurity framework does your organization follow? Please check all that apply. NIST, ISO, COSO, CIS, CMMS, FISMA, or other. Again, if you'd like CPE credit, please record a response to this question. Thank you. We'll give everybody a couple more seconds to respond to this question.
All right. It looks like we got a lot of answers kind of all across the board here. I am glad to see that seems like most organizations or most of our participants are following or have identified some sort of framework to benchmark themselves against. Hope you remember all of these acronyms. I am going to reference these throughout the next few slides. And that cybersecurity maturity model certification, there's a little typo there that should be CMMC. But without further ado, let's go ahead and get into the last section, which is going to be everybody's favorite topic, cybersecurity and information technology. So I wanted to just run through some of the most significant changes here, which are really going to center around these three areas. Once you all get a copy of the slide decks, these are links that you can reference the actual CFR to read the actual guidance, but we'll go ahead and cover these on the next few slides here. So regarding our first change, this item, if we're looking at bullet number one here, this really revolves around gaining an understanding of the risk evaluation process for federal agencies when they are reviewing your grant proposal or your grant award and agreement. So it's really important to understand what's going to be applicable to your organization. Tricia had mentioned reaching out in preparation to your auditors to understand what they see from an audit perspective as being kind of the most critical controls to focus on. But then if you also have contacts or representatives from any of the funding agencies that you work with, would recommend also reaching out to them to better understand the components of their risk evaluation process, specifically those that are going to be related to cybersecurity and information technology, as this may vary slightly from agency to agency, depending on who is performing the evaluation. Item number two here just references the fact that this particular change makes reference to management systems and standards, which doesn't specifically call out information technology and cybersecurity, but that can, the assumption is that that includes the information technology requirements. So this section, again, doesn't reference a specific framework. However, on the next slide, we're going to go into some of these specific frameworks that are mentioned under section 200.303, which does reference compliance to standards for internal control in the federal government or the COSO framework. So it's recommended as a best practice for any organization to identify a framework or even potentially a blend of frameworks that's most appropriate for your organization based on your size and operating structure. So, for example, a domestic organization may choose to leverage NIST CSF 2.0 or the National Institute for Standardization and Technology, the Cybersecurity Framework 2.0, or maybe even the Center for Internet Security Framework, whereas an international non-governmental organization may choose to leverage ISO or the International Organization for Standardization Framework. If you don't follow a specific framework, or if you can't support adherence through documentation or a formal and independent evaluation, benchmark, or assessment of your IT controls, this isn't going to necessarily preclude you from successfully winning any awards, but it may result in additional efforts to reduce the perceived risk associated with your organization's cybersecurity posture. So, for example, an organization that submits proof of a benchmarking exercise against ISO, COSO, NIST, performed by an independent third party may sufficiently address the cyber risk evaluation requirements under their funding agency, whereas an organization that can't provide such an evaluation, they might be required to fill out additional questionnaires, provide copies of policies or procedures, or maybe even meet with the risk assessors or the evaluator to walk through certain controls. Item number three then gets into the monitoring and evaluation procedures, and this is going to be directly tied to the risk assessment. So high-risk entities are going to be forced to comply with more stringent requirements, such as more frequent reporting or more detailed reporting, whereas a low-risk organization will probably benefit from less frequent reviews or more lax reporting requirements. So therefore, it seeks to benefit the grantee to proactively address risks to address or to avoid additional expenses associated with the monitoring and evaluation requirements. And to help illustrate this, if you need to allocate additional staff, time, materials, resources to comply with the monitoring and evaluation requirements, that ultimately is going to come at a dollar value, right? You could quantify that based on the level of effort and all the time and resources that go into it. Could you spend a similar amount of money to proactively address cybersecurity risks and hopefully take your perceived risk from a high to a moderate, or maybe even from a high to a low, which would then ultimately reduce the monitoring and evaluation requirements? So the importance of this is that those expenses for monitoring and evaluation are really only going to serve that one program because they're going to be specific to that particular grant. Whereas if you invest in cybersecurity measures, not only will it benefit the specific grant, but it's likely to benefit the organization at large. So it's really important to consider that in your cost-benefit analysis when you're evaluating the feasibility of any IT or cybersecurity projects. And real quick, I'm going to make some changes because it looks like my video is looking a little odd. So just want to make sure I'm not dealing with any technical difficulties here. So on this next slide, we talk about 200.303, which is internal controls. And as I mentioned, the guidance does specifically reference a couple of different frameworks, that being the Standards for Internal Control in the Federal Government, and then the COSO Internal Control Integrated Framework. Now, I wanted to spend the majority of our time going over these items because this is probably what most people are concerned with in regards to how can we prepare for these new requirements. So I just wanted to go through the control COSO framework here and kind of relate this specifically to IT and cybersecurity. So as we can see on this little diagram here, we have the control environment, the risk assessment procedures, control activities, information and communication, and monitoring activities that make up the components and the principles under COSO. You can then look at these at the entity level, division, operational unit, function, all the way down to the individual control level. So starting with the control environment, the control environment really sets the tone for the organization and influences the control consciousness of its employees. In the context of IT and cybersecurity, this is going to include your governance structure. So establishing clear roles and responsibilities related to IT security management. This is really going to focus on the individuals who are designing and implementing the controls, but also trickle all the way down to your end users or the employees of the organization who are going to be interacting with the systems and data on a day-to-day basis. The next area is policies and procedures. So Tricia emphasized this in talking about preparations under uniform guidance, and this principle is explicitly stated within the COSO framework. So your organization should develop robust IT policies that help to enforce the security protocols and ensure compliance with regulatory requirements. This is regardless of your size and structure. You should have a custom tailored policy for your organization, regardless of if you leverage a managed service provider or an outside consultant, regardless of if you're fully cloud-based and you don't have any on-premise IT assets. The policies should reflect your current risk profile and be customized to your structure and incorporate information relevant to any kind of outside parties you leverage in designing and implementing your controls. And then lastly, under the control environment, we have just ethics and integrity. So fostering a culture of security awareness and ethical behavior regarding data handling and IT resources. Tricia emphasized the importance of training. That is paramount when talking about IT, doing that end user training to prevent any kind of phishing scams, malware, ransomware, things like that from occurring. The second area is the risk assessment practices. So this component involves identifying and analyzing risks that could impact the achievement of objectives. So for IT and cybersecurity, this is going to typically include, at a minimum, your threat identification process. So how you identify potential internal and external threats to your IT systems, those risks being malware, phishing, insider threats. Threat identification could be vulnerability scanning, regular evaluation and monitoring, performing any kind of phishing training, so actually testing employees as to their ability to identify phishing emails. This will also include vulnerability assessments, so actually analyzing the weaknesses in your IT infrastructure that could be exploited by attackers, internal and external. And then just risk analysis, evaluating the results of these identified risks of your vulnerability assessments and assessing the potential impact and likelihood of these various risks. That way you can prioritize and mitigate them effectively. Our third area is control activities, or the existing control activities that are in place. So these are the actions that help mitigate risks and ensure the achievement of objectives. In an IT context, this will include, again, at a minimum, access controls, which are really what we emphasize and focus on as part of the financial statement and single audit process. So this is implementing user authentication and authorization mechanisms to protect sensitive data and systems. Change management, which establishes protocols for software updates, system changes, changes to user permissions and access rights, as well as configuration management of the systems to prevent unauthorized alterations to data and information. And then lastly, we have monitoring and logging, which kind of goes hand in hand with change management, but also applies to other activity within the IT environment. So this is regularly reviewing and logging access to systems, as well as changes made to those systems. And monitoring for any kind of unusual activity or breaches. The fourth area is information and communication. Effective information and communication ensures that relevant information flows throughout the organization. So all the way from your IT department down to the individual end users, up to senior management and to the board of directors. For IT and cybersecurity, this is going to involve focusing on data integrity. So ensuring that information used in the decision-making process is accurate, timely, and secure. Incident reporting, which will establish clear channels for reporting security incidents and breaches, allowing for quick response and communication. And then training and awareness, providing ongoing training for your employees on IT policies, security best practices, and how to recognize cyber threats. Last but not least, we have monitoring activities, which help to ensure the ongoing effectiveness of controls. So for IT cybersecurity, this is going to focus on continuous monitoring, what you're doing on an ongoing basis, what tools you're leveraging and processes to continuously assess the effectiveness of security controls and detect any anomalies. This could also include performance of any internal audits, conducting regular audits of the IT systems and their controls to identify areas for improvement and ensure compliance with policies and any regulatory frameworks. And then lastly, developing performance metrics. So key performance indicators, KPIs, or key risk indicators, KRIs, developing these metrics to evaluate the performance and risk level associated with IT controls. And this will also help to inform management decisions. So with that, I will jump into the last section, which I, again, I'm sure is a big concern to most people, because this is actually going to impact your bottom line. So with these new cybersecurity considerations, cybersecurity and IT costs can actually now be charged as direct expenses to the grant as opposed to indirect. So previously, they were treated as indirect, added to the indirect cost bucket, and allocated to the programs based on your NICRA, the 10%, or now up to 15% de minimis rate, and charged to the grant as such. So in short, you're going to be able to actually charge more costs to the grant than you used to, which will help your overall operating budget. So it's important to note that these direct costs should be built into your grant budgets. This should be discussed with the donor and funder to ensure these costs are allowable based on the program's operations and the nature of the cost, and that these costs are then supported by the appropriate documentation in order to prepare for the audit. So to support the direct costs charged to your grant, it's important to have this included in the budget. That budget should be reflective of the organization's total cost for IT and cybersecurity, as well as the overall risk assessment for the organization for the specific program or grant. So generally speaking, just to provide a little context to this, organizations typically spend around 2 to 5% of annual revenue on information technology, which includes cybersecurity. Of that total amount, maybe 5 to 20% is spent on cybersecurity. And these are all just kind of general ranges. So for example, if you have $10 million in revenue and you expend 3% of your annual revenue on IT cybersecurity, you'd have an overall budget of $300,000. And then say out of that, maybe 10% is spent on cybersecurity. So that would be about $30,000 that is going strictly to cybersecurity, whether that's vulnerability scanning, evaluation, training, cyber insurance, all of those costs. And then the remaining balance of that is just going to be your ongoing support, maintenance, your licensing fees, For anybody who's familiar with the pricing around an ERP or an accounting system, that alone can run six figures on an annual basis. So that's where the majority of that goes. Combine that with all of your expense management, data storage, grants and contracts management, procurement systems. It adds up very quickly. So just wanted to provide those numbers just to provide a little bit more context to the new considerations here. So again, whatever your organization's breakdown looks like, this information should be incorporated into the grant budget to support those amounts being allocated as direct costs. But with that, I know that was a pretty quick overview, so please feel free to reach out if you have any questions following the webinar. Please also check out our GRF On The Go podcast, where we're regularly discussing hot topics and emerging trends in the industry. Also, please feel free to connect with any of us on LinkedIn to keep the conversation going, follow up with any questions. But with that, I just wanted to thank everybody. I'll turn things back over to Andrew to see if we have some time to answer any questions from the group.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mac and Tricia and John as well. I was monitoring the chat throughout the webinar. It looks like we had a really active Q&A session. I believe all those questions have been responded to. I did notice one kind of recurring theme, and I totally understand because it is confusing. So, John, would you be able to provide just a breakdown one more time about the effective dates? Because, you know, there are two effective dates, you know, one for the actual revisions to the 2CFR and then one for the actual audit implication. So I think there was some confusion there. So, John, if you don't mind just saying a few words on that.
Sure. So the effective date is October 1 as it relates to the grants themselves. So all of the updates and subparts A through E are effective for grants made on or after October 1 and for grants that were modified to include the revisions. So since the audit requirements are based on fiscal years and not on an effective date, you have to wait for an entire audit fiscal year to go by before the audit requirements can be effective. So that's why for the audit requirements, they're effective for fiscal years that begin after October 1. So we can't have, if your fiscal year ends December 31st, 2024, we can't split the year for, you know, for your CEFA purposes. So that's why you have to wait for an entire year to go by.
Thanks for that clarification, John. And Mac, with the a minute or so that we have left, you know, you were talking through the different frameworks. Can you just provide some information? How would an organization know if they were in compliance with the COSO framework?
Yeah, so my initial recommendation would just be to perform a baseline risk assessment, review those five elements of COSO that we just walked through and document how your organization does or does not comply in an instances where you don't comply, design policies, procedures, or new controls to cover those gaps. And I'm going to put something in the chat right now, which is just kind of a tool everybody can use. This is an executive summary of the integrated control framework, and you can actually pay for and download the entire integrated control framework in detail. But this executive summary helps in performing just a baseline high level assessment. And to just walk through one of these in a quick example, if you go down to page 14 of the PDF or page 6 of the report, it starts breaking down those five components that we covered into the individual principles. So for an example, just to address the very first one there, this reads, the organization demonstrates a commitment to integrity and ethical values. So my response for our organization would be that we have an employee manual. We have a code of conduct, including conflict of interest policies that require annual disclosure and sign off. We have an anti-fraud and whistleblower program, and we have periodic ethics trainings for all employees. I would then compile all of that documentation into one nice, neat folder so that when it comes time for the audit process, I can turn that over. Or when it comes time to respond to any kind of pre-award risk assessment on the part of the funding agencies, I can then provide that documentation to address how we comply with the COSO framework.
All right. Thank you very much, Mac. And I appreciate everybody attending today's discussion. Don't forget to complete that survey at the end of the webinar to receive your CPE credit. Thank you all very much and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the GRF On The Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.